The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. As the winds stack up for Donald Trump, so does the possibility of a contested or brokered convention. Fellow GOP candidate John Kasich welcomes it, asking, can you think of anything cooler than a convention where we're going to learn about how America works? Well, it turns out that many Americans can think of much cooler things because not many of us know what a brokered convention is. Conventions in recent memory have been more like pep rallies for the candidates with the most votes and the blessing of the party. So what would it mean if the nomination depends on four contentious days in Cleveland? Well, political scientist Seth Maskett can explain. He's associate professor at the University of Denver. Hi, Seth.
Hi, how are you?
Please help us. We use brokered and contested conventions in that introduction interchangeably. Is that correct?
Well, brokered is a pretty common term for it. I think it's somewhat inaccurate. It sort of refers back to a time when there were actual brokers. There were governors or local party bosses who really commanded a large group of delegates, and you would have to negotiate with them in order to win their delegates over. We don't really have a system like that today, although it's certainly possible we could have a contested convention, which would simply mean one in which we really don't know the outcome going into it, in which there's not no candidate has a majority of pledged delegates before the thing starts.
So how is that different from what we have come to think of as a normal convention, you know, sort of a pro forma thing?
Yeah, well, in the modern era, I mean, really for the last 60-plus years, candidates have been able to accrue enough pledged delegates through primaries and caucuses and other means that the convention itself really isn't much of a surprise. And it serves other purposes. It's an opportunity for a party to get its message out to a lot of voters and for the party to essentially meet and decide what its platform is. But it's been a while since we've actually had multiple ballots in which there's horse trading going on to determine who the nominee is going to be.
Okay, so let's imagine a contested convention. Put us in the room there in Cleveland. Who's there?
Oh, man. So, you have a lot of different rooms, which is kind of the key thing. There'll be maybe anywhere from 40% or more of the delegates in the room will be pledged Trump supporters. You'll have some, a bunch of people who are pledged to Ted Cruz. You'll have a handful of Kasich supporters. You'll also have a bunch of people who were pledged to candidates who have since dropped out.
Are they actually in different rooms?
No, they'll all be on the convention floor, but there are meetings before we get to the convention floor. There will be meetings of a committee designed to determine what the party's platform is, and there'll be meetings to discuss the rules of the convention before the convention starts.
Do delegates actually cast physical ballots at the convention?
They will actually cast votes. They will be counted. In theory, the convention is supposed to count the first vote as to how people are officially pledged. If they were elected as a pledged delegate for some candidate, that's how their vote is supposed to be counted. But the rules can be different, particularly for candidates who have dropped out. In some cases, they could be just considered free agents and they can vote for whomever they want. In some cases, they're really supposed to vote and be recorded for whoever they were initially pledged to. Different state parties have different rules for these sorts of things. The convention can decide how to count these sorts of things. So if it ends up being a very close first roll call, you know, these sorts of rules could end up making a big difference.
So these are physical people, delegates, they're mm-hmm. actual human beings. Are they being wooed by party officials, by campaigns at this point to, you know, say those Rubio people to come on over to another side?
If we actually get to a point where no candidate has a majority of delegates going into the convention, yes, that's just the sort of thing that will be happening. You know, particularly the candidates that have already dropped out, those delegates will be considered up for grabs. And the Trump campaign officials will be approaching them and trying to woo them and convince them why they should rally behind him. The Cruz people will be attempting to win them over and making arguments to them. And then there will simply be a vote. And if no candidate gets to the majority, one of the candidates that got far fewer ballots will offer to make a deal with someone.
Okay, so a couple things. What happens if they have not reached consensus after the 4-day convention?
Honestly,
is that
I don't
possible?
Know. I don't know.
Any precedent for that?
We have seen incredibly lengthy conventions with multiple ballots. I mean, the last time we had contested presidential conventions was there was one in 1948 and one in 1952. Those only had two or three ballots each. Back in 1924, there was one. I believe there were more than 100 ballots cast before the Democrats were able to settle on a nominee. So this certainly can go on long, and it is, it is the party's one job at that point to actually select someone. So they're operating under a deadline, and they recognize that they have really one main task for that convention.
But it is possible for the party to nominate someone who does not have or did not have a lead in the popular vote.
Yes, absolutely. If Donald Trump could go into this convention with a plurality of the pledged delegates, but not a majority of them, and if that's the case, then after that first ballot, if there's no majority candidate at that point, it's anyone's game. Really, they could nominate anyone they want, and there's no obvious reason that it has to be the person who won the most contests up until that point.
We have been hearing about these are the numbers of delegates that each candidate has earned in each primary state, and this is what they need to win the nomination. But what meaning does that number have at the conventions? If all of the votes could conceivably change, or the numbers of votes and committed delegates could change at the convention?
Yes, those numbers we've been following so far with the number of delegates that candidates have won in each of these contests really only refers to their vote on the first ballot, if this becomes a contested convention. And after that first ballot, delegates are theoretically free to vote for whomever they want. And so that's where you could get a lot of different negotiation and a lot of horse trading going on. Now, of course, those people have been selected for these jobs in a lot of states because they're very loyal to those candidates. So it's not like you'll have like a whole bunch of Trump people just very eager to just quickly cast their Trump vote and then switch to someone else. They really are very big supporters of Donald Trump.
Of course, one of the big talking points throughout this primary season has been a rejection of party politics, a rejection of the establishment, choosing outsider candidates. It sounds to me like conventions used to be pretty much, like moving around the chess pieces for the parties. What do you think this idea of a contested convention spells out for the parties? Are those brokers of yore going to be running the show?
Well, in many ways, this does harken back to an earlier era where party conventions really were essentially a few hundred or a few thousand party leaders gathering together to make a decision on behalf of the rest of the country. And that's the system that actually, produced some excellent leaders. Franklin Roosevelt, Abraham Lincoln, and a number of others came out of these sorts of contested conventions. But, there's no guarantee that they get it any more correct than voters do.
Seth, why is this so confusing?
Well, in part because we tend to think of parties as, at least modern American parties, as these very democratically run organizations where ordinary people have a really strong say. We get to participate in primaries and caucuses, and we, the people, get to decide who the party's nominee is. And it turns out it isn't really that direct. There are certainly democratic aspects to it, but ultimately this decision is made by a convention that we have some ability to shape, but only some, and they are really free to make what decisions they want.
Well, Seth, thank you very much. I feel a little bit better armed.
I hope so.
Seth Maskett is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Denver. Now, you'll find more about the possibility of a contested convention, don't say brokered, at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us on Facebook and on Twitter. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Walk into any pharmacy or drugstore today and you'll find products on the shelves that 100 years ago people could only dream of. This next story from the podcast Mother explains the strange origins of a simple product that often produces anxiety, but is nevertheless something we now take for granted.
Well, it was in February of 1984. One of my employees came in and she said, "You're pregnant. I dreamt about a fish last night." And she said, "And it's you. It has to be." I said, "No, that can't possibly be."
That's Gloria Allen. She didn't take her employee's fish dream at face value, though she did buy a pregnancy test. But back in the early 80s, the test wasn't the neat little wand that we use today.
It was like a little science kit. It had a beaker, you know, and I probably read the instructions 50 times before I do it because I didn't want to mess it up.
This tiny chemistry set may have been difficult to use, but it was the very first pregnancy test that a woman could do all on her own, right in her own bathroom.
And I saw the little ring start to form. I got excited. I was like, okay, maybe this is really working. And you keep looking at the picture going, is it a ring? Is it? Am I sure it's a ring? Yeah, it's a ring. You know, is that how it is now? There's either a plus or a minus or whatever. You know, no, you had to really look at it.
It was a long journey to get to those little plastic wands we all take for granted today. It required a lot of intense biochemical research spread out over about 100 years. I'm Ann Noyes-Sanny.
And I'm Amy Gastelum. And we're going to tell you about that research. Some of it is pretty weird.
And we're also going to tell you about a key player who's largely been left out of the story.
But before we get there, a little more about the science that made it possible. In the early days, pregnancy testing was kind of a grisly business.
That's right. Back in 1927, these two German gynecologists devised the first modern pregnancy test. They injected mice with women's urine, and then they dissected the mice to see if their ovaries had changed.
If they had changed, it meant the pregnancy hormone in the woman's urine triggered the animal's reproductive system. That hormone is called human chorionic gonadotropin, or HCG for short. It's made by the placenta, and the important thing is that it's only there during pregnancy. Since then, all pregnancy tests, including the ones we have today, search for this hormone. So, this early pregnancy test worked, but it was also really complicated, and it took a long time to get results. And you had to kill a mouse, or a rabbit, or a rat, every single time.
Lucky for all the furry animals, by the late 1940s, labs started using toads for pregnancy tests. They got results faster, and the toads weren't killed. They could be used more than once.
I think they were rested for 2 or 3 weeks, and then used again.
That's Audrey Peaty. Back in the early 50s, she worked in a lab outside London. Her job was to make concentrates of urine samples sent by doctors all over the region.
We then took half the sample and injected it into a toad, which was then put into a jar. And that was put overnight into a warm room on a trolley. And in the morning, if the toad had laid lots and lots of eggs, that hormone was present. So the person was pregnant.
So the HCG in the women's urine would make the toad lay eggs.
Disgusting.
Perhaps. In the late 1960s, a Swedish medical student named Leif Vida figured out a way to do the whole test in a small glass tube. No toads needed.
So here's the ridiculously simple explanation. And again, HCG, our pregnancy hormone, was the key. Vida put some chemicals in a test tube, then added a few drops of lady urine. If the urine mixed with the chemicals and turned into a cloudy mess, she was not pregnant. But if she was pregnant, something altogether different happened. The HCG in her urine caused a ring to form at the bottom of the tube.
Remember Gloria from the very beginning? That's the ring she saw in her pregnancy test. So back to that Swedish med student. He partnered with a Dutch pharmaceutical company called Organon to manufacture this new pregnancy test. But the test was only done in labs, and only if a doctor requested it.
So this is the 1960s. If you think you're pregnant, you have to go to your doctor, and he could send off your urine to be tested, but he'd only do that if he thought there was something wrong. If you seemed healthy but just curious to know, too bad.
Yeah, so all of that started to change one fateful day in 1967. A young designer named Meg Crane was working freelance for Organon when she saw some pregnancy tests in their lab in New Jersey.
And looking at that, I thought, well, how simple that would be. All you need is a test tube and a mirror, and a woman could do it herself.
At the time, Crane was designing Organon's cosmetic products, but this idea that a woman could do that simple lab test herself, she couldn't shake it.
I went home to New York and I kept thinking about it, and I started working on different models out of other styrofoam or cardboard or whatever else to try to make it happen. And I had on my desk a little plastic box with a cap, and it was a perfect thing. It just happened. It was perfect. And that's what I based the model on and took it to them.
Crane took Vita's test and redesigned it for women to use by themselves. She wasn't commissioned to work on this. It was a passion project. And when she showed her design to an executive she knew at Organon,
he sort of laughed and said, you know, that maybe somebody else could do this, but we can't.
We, meaning Organon. At the time, almost half of Organon's business was selling pregnancy testing to doctors. So the idea of selling tests directly to women sounded totally crazy.
In Britain, a few pharmacies had started doing just that, letting women submit their urine for pregnancy tests, no doctor involved. And not everybody was happy about that. An article from a British newspaper in 1969 warns,
women who apply for pregnancy tests to pharmacists instead of visiting their doctor may be risking their lives, the British Medical Association warned yesterday. So this is a radical statement. It's not coming from a kind of quack or a fringe doctor. It's coming from the British Medical Association.
Risking their lives.
Right. That's Dr. Jesse Olshenko Grin. He's a researcher at Cambridge University, and he studies the history of pregnancy testing.
I mean, this really does sound crazy today, but, you know, the article continues that women who are not happy about a positive result might do something drastic like commit suicide.
Doctors in the late 60s were convinced that women just couldn't handle knowing they were pregnant without a doctor to counsel them.
But to Meg Crane, that sounded crazy. Why did you need a doctor, who was inevitably a man, to deliver this very personal news?
Just as a woman, I thought, why couldn't you know this yourself? You know, for all purposes. You know, if you were young, married, and wanted to find out, you know, what's going on here, are you pregnant or not? And if you weren't married and were worried about what you'd have to do if you weren't, you'd want to know, period. You'd want to know yourself and not have some authority tell you this.
But Crane wasn't trying to make a political statement with her home test prototype. She just thought, the science is there. Why not make it available to women directly?
And eventually, that's what happened. Organon's leadership, based in the very liberal Netherlands, got wind of Crane's idea, and they liked it. They started selling her test in Canada in 1971, and it finally came out in the U.S. in 1977, a decade after Crane had first visited that Organon lab.
Today, home pregnancy tests are a multi-million dollar industry. But Crane never made any money from her invention. She couldn't afford to file for the patents, so she gave Organon the rights because she knew they could get the test into women's homes.
By the way, we did reach out to Organon's parent company, Merck, to get their side of all this, but they declined to comment.
Anyway, now it's hard to imagine a world without easy, private access to pregnancy tests.
But Crane kept her role in all of that to herself and just went on with her life.
And the prototype that she built and hawked around at Organon, she kept it packed away in a box in her apartment for 40 years.
Until June 2015, when she put it up for auction in New York City.
Sells you, Christina, 4660.
The buyer was the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History in Washington, D.C.
So we're going to walk down the hall to our storage room.
Alexandra Lord is the chair and a curator of the museum's History of Medicine and Science collection. She puts on gloves before picking up the small plastic box.
And if you look at it, it's not very sexy to look at. In many ways, it's very simple and straightforward. It's basically just a plastic box with a mirror on the bottom, an angled mirror, and two test tubes. It's a really interesting comment on how someone who's not a scientist, Margaret Crane was a graphic designer, can play a major role in getting a scientific product into the hands of the general public.
Crane's prototype started as a paperclip box. Now it's being handled with gloves and humidity control.
That's right. It's taken up residence among our nation's most prestigious medical artifacts.
One of the things about being a historian is that we're always looking at something in hindsight, and at the time, we don't always recognize the major breakthroughs that are occurring. So sometimes it takes 20, 30, 40 years before we really understand how important something was.
I
We're Ann Noy Sani
and Amy Gastelum from the podcast Mother.
And that piece was part of the STEM Story Project. It's distributed by PRX and made possible with funds from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Remember when the App Store first came online in 2008? Back then, a smartphone was like a blank slate, and the App Store was a strange new world of easy-to-download possibilities. There were practical apps for getting the news or finding movie times at your local theaters. There were novelty apps like the virtual koi pond or the one that turned your phone into a lightsaber. It was a brand new marketplace where any developer with a good idea and a knack for writing code could carve out a niche and make it big. But all that is changing. Casey Newton is Silicon Valley editor at The Verge. He recently wrote about how app fatigue among users and a crowded marketplace for developers are shrinking opportunities and profits on the App Store. And Casey, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Oh, I'm happy to be here.
So it's crazy to think about the fact that the App Store is only 8 years old. Can you take us back to that time, 2008, and remind us what that marketplace looked like when the App Store first opened?
Absolutely. Well, you know, it's hard to remember now, but when the iPhone came out, it didn't have an App Store. And when Steve Jobs announced it on stage, he said, you know what, you don't need to have native apps on this phone. You can just make web apps, and you can just sort of navigate to those on your mobile phone browser and do everything inside your web browser. And developers said, no, we can make way better apps if you just kind of give us access to the phone. And so a year later, Steve Jobs relented. And just as you said, it was a completely blank slate then, and developers had all sorts of ideas for things that they could build, and they did that right away. It was sort of a hit from the very beginning.
Right, and of course the joke came out, you know, there's an app for that. There was something for absolutely everything. When did the app boom kind of hit its peak?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I mean, I think from Apple's perspective, they would tell you that maybe the App Store hasn't hit its peak. And when you look at sort of the absolute number of dollars that are being made, that's probably higher than ever. But if you want to look at it from the perspective of maybe a smaller independent developer, I think it can be argued that the peak of the App Store was maybe sometime within those first 3 or 4 years, because during that time, consumers were still looking for apps all the time. People would open up the App Store on their phone. They'd kind of hunt around. They would see what was at the top of the charts. They would see what Apple had featured, and they were sort of much more willing to play around. And so even if you just made a simple utility, like some of the guys that I wrote about in my story, they made an app for editing photos, they could sell that for a couple of bucks and actually make a really good living for themselves. So during that whole sort of first 3 or 4 years of the App Store, there's a lot of money to be made, even among people that didn't have huge marketing budgets.
So how many apps are there now?
There are about 1.5 million apps in the iOS App Store, and about 1.6 million in the Google Play Store, which is the equivalent on Android. There are a lot of complaints about the quality of search in app stores. It can be very hard to find an app unless you know the exact name. Sometimes even if you do know the exact name, it might not pop up right away. And so developers really rely on trying to get their app onto the top of the most downloaded charts, because that is still a sort of a very visible place where a lot of consumers will still see it. But of course, in order to get onto those most downloaded charts, you typically have to spend a lot on ads in order to get people to download it.
What is the app economy worth right now?
You know, I don't know the total number, but I think if you take a look at the sort of most successful developer in the App Store, it's a company named Supercell. They make a game that you may have heard of called Clash of Clans. Supercell alone in 2014 reported revenues of $1.7 billion. That's probably at the far extreme of what a company can make, but it's certainly safe to say that revenue generated in the App Store is in the billions.
Well, that breaks down for just Supercell, 2.4 million a day. That's just
yeah.
Amazing. I mean, no wonder it drew so many people. But how about our use of apps? How has that changed over the year? And how is that changing the app economy here in the U.S.?
You know, I think when the App Store first came out, one of the things that was exciting about it was it felt like every time you visited the App Store, your phone would get a new superpower, right? Like, I'll never forget the first time I heard of Shazam, this app that lets you, so it'll tell you the name of a song
right,
that's playing
around
you, right?
You play the song and it tells you what the name of it is.
Yeah, it's like, it's amazing, right? No more just like stumbling around the grocery store, like trying to remember a few lines of the song so you can go home and Google it later, right? And so there are all kinds of apps like these that really made you feel like kind of a little superhero, right? Uber is another one where it's like I can just summon a car to me and then go anywhere I want for less than the cost of a taxi. So there was a lot of that in the early days. But what we found was that over time, most people's use of apps actually kind of revolved around maybe just three apps. There are some studies that show that people will spend upwards of 80% of their time in just their top three apps, which for most people would be like a messaging app, an email app, and Facebook. I would say those are kind of the three big ones. And once those apps have 80% of your time, it doesn't leave a lot of room for apps that are maybe just kind of silly or fun utilities. You know, games continue to do really well. But outside of games, most of our time really does kind of focus on those core utilities that are centered around communicating with our friends and family.
I'm talking about the App Store economy, a once boundless marketplace, now pretty crowded, where, according to Casey Newton, too much competition and too little interest is squeezing out these smaller and medium-sized developers. Casey is Silicon Valley editor at The Verge. Now, Casey, you write that successful companies today just can't build a new app and expect it to succeed. You mentioned the marketing muscle that they have to maintain profits. You know, are we watching the same thing happen, that those that have the money, they can make money, those that don't have the money, they cannot?
I think that that is largely true. You know, I think that in the early days of the App Store, there is what I think of as the middle class, where if you were a moderately good developer with a moderately good idea, you could sell your app for a couple of dollars and you could probably make, you know, $100,000 in a year, right? Probably enough to feed your family. So really good money, particularly for people who'd been doing mostly freelance work before, which is the case for the guys that I wrote about in my story. But what happened was, as the App Store got more crowded, that middle class started to get hollowed out. And so now the vast majority of the businesses that are built on the App Store tend to fall into one of two categories. You have these solo developers who maybe have a partner, but typically these companies just are not bigger than two people because the maximum revenues that they can generate are going to top out around, I don't know, let's say between $100,000 and $200,000 a year. And then you have these companies that are backed by venture capital, so companies that go out and raise, you know, $5, $10, $15 million, and part of the reason that they raise that money is so that they can market their apps. So again, to use this example of Supercell, which is the extreme example because they make the most money and spend the most money on marketing, they made $1.7 billion in 2014. But they spent $440 million on marketing, right? So, and like every one of those dollars they spent to buy a customer. Mm-hmm. So when you have people who are going to spend $440 million on marketing, it just makes it very difficult for a team of five or six or 10 people, which you did see a little bit more of back in the earlier days.
So this leads me to ask, with these companies backed up by venture capital, you know, and not actually selling any product, are we looking at an app bubble?
It's a question that we hear a lot in Silicon Valley. I started writing about tech here in 2010, and for the last 5 years, people have been telling me that we're in a bubble. It still hasn't quite popped yet. A difference between sort of last time and this time is that in the dot-com bubble of the late 90s, you had a lot of companies that had no revenues even that were going public. And then you had a lot of public pension funds that were buying those stocks. And so when the sort of music stopped and all those companies died, had this huge impact on the national economy. The app economy is a little bit different. If these apps were to go out of business, because their companies are for the most part privately held, the only people who would really lose money are the venture capitalists. So it isn't that there would be no impact, but I think the impact would be smaller. But that said, it's not clear to me that we're in a bubble exactly, because people are still making, you know, millions or in a handful of cases, billions of dollars on the App Store. It's just the kinds of businesses that are making money have really changed, and that making money, I think, requires just a lot more sophistication than it would have 5 or 10 years ago.
Are there any little scrappy app developers now hitting in the top of the charts, or are those days behind us?
That's, well, you know, there's one that I wrote about in my story that I would say is scrappy, even though they're now 50 people. But when they started out, it was just 4 or 5 guys. They're these Israelis. They have a company called Lightrix, and they made this insanely popular app called Facetune that just did one thing well, which was it helped you take the perfect selfie. And Lightrix sold this app for $5, which is really expensive by today's standards. But the thing just did gangbusters. There's a flip side of it, though, and one of the reasons that I think of Lightrix as a really scrappy company is not only did they write software for this cute selfie app, but they also wrote software to figure out how to essentially game the most downloaded charts, because they realized that they could buy a certain number of installs every day using Facebook ads, and they sort of wrote software to sort of optimize that, figure out exactly how much money they needed to spend on Facebook so that they could stay at the top of the download charts, which would in turn drive more downloads. And by sort of perfecting that, they were able to create what looks like a really sustainable business. They've since raised millions of dollars of venture capital. They've expanded to 50 people. But it just took so much more sophistication than something like that would have taken in 2008.
Could you have guessed how all this was going to play out in 2008 when that app store first opened?
No, but I'm terrible at predicting things. That's why I like being a reporter, is you just get to watch what happens.
Casey Newton, thank you for speaking with us.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
Casey Newton, he's Silicon Valley editor at The Verge. You'll find a link to read his article, Life and Death in the App Store, at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Truth is a hard thing to pin down, perhaps no more so than during an election season. Good thing we're in the information age, right? With a sea of facts and sources at our fingertips. The truth is just a Google search away. Not so fast, says philosopher Michael Patrick Lynch in his new book, The Internet of Us, Knowing More and Understanding Less in the Age of Big Data. He argues that technology is reshaping our relationship to the truth, moving us further away from it. And Michael Patrick Lynch is a professor of philosophy at the University of Connecticut. Welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me.
So this election season, voters have had a lot of resources to track the truth. We've got PolitiFact, factcheck.org, the Washington Post does this Pinocchio rating. So why do you think that we're understanding less?
Well, I think for two basic reasons. First, just to emphasize, we do, of course, due to the digital devices that we all carry around in our pockets, we do have access to much, much more information than humans have ever had access to before. And that's an astounding fact all on its own. It's something that we tend to, I think, overlook because in an amazingly quick amount of time, we've become so used to it. And so, in fact, dependent on the sort of information that we can have literally at our fingertips. One way in which that sort of comes out is in the fact that when was the last time, probably pretty recently, you were in some meeting or at a dinner party and somebody says something that's sort of contentious and everybody races to their cell phone, right, to see who's the first one that can Google it and find out the truth. But given all that, despite all that, I think that a lot of us are feeling more and more that we somehow are missing out on what I call understanding or a deeper form of knowledge. We're not at least getting it from the stream of information from the devices that we carry around in our pockets in the ways that we might have hoped. I think there are really two main reasons. So first, the internet is the greatest fact checker, but also the greatest bias confirmer that was ever invented.
Well, what do you mean by that?
But by that, I mean, when we check things online, if we're on the left politically, we check certain blog posts and certain news sources. And if we're on the right, we check other blog posts and other news sources. And as a result, we tend to find online confirmation of the things that we already believe. The other reason that I think that this mere fact that we have so much more information isn't necessarily increasing the sort of complex form of knowledge I was talking about before is that the fact that we have so much information itself tends to make us overconfident about our ability to get knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
We think that the mere fact that there are these fact-checking sites out there really gives us a sense that, well, if somebody says something crazy, well, you know, maybe it's not as crazy because, after all, somebody would have pointed it out.
Okay, I want to just dig into that a little bit because there's so much there. And I looked earlier, confirmation bias, you know, built into the search engine algorithm. For example, when I type climate change into Google, it auto-completes with climate change facts, climate change definition, then climate change hoax. Is Google sort of confirming the kind of things that we look for, in your mind, a bigger threat to the truth than not having access to information?
No. The technology itself isn't the problem. The problem is our unreflective use of it. Just because Google Complete is saying that a lot of people have searched for this doesn't give it any more credence or any more plausibility as a truth. People in general are hardwired, it seems, psychologists are telling us, to engage in confirmation bias. That, however, we can, right, through critical reflection and patience, we can correct for that.
Okay, so to your second point, this kind of idea that we have so much information that we think we have a lot more knowledge, you're making me think of you remember on the Colbert Report, this kind of idea of truthiness?
Exactly.
Right? You know, that something seeming or felt to be true, even if it were not necessarily true. How does technology play into that sort of concept of truthiness?
One way in which it plays into it, is, as I mentioned before, is the mere speed and availability of it can lead us to be overconfident. But another way that it plays into it is by allowing us to see images and quick posts that emotionally resonate with us and speak to what we think is a deeper truth without necessarily providing a lot of information that goes along with that. Here's an example of that. Think about all these sites that are very prevalent on Facebook. 5 things you need to know right now about Donald Trump. Those sites are often filled with inaccurate information, but they use the term fact, right, in a way that makes people, if they're not paying close attention, think that what's being said must have been verified or thought through.
So we have access to more information than ever, but you say that we're understanding less. And I'm trying to understand what you mean by that, that we are not able to process this much information, that we just reach for the lowest hanging fruit. What is that?
Well, that's partly it. Understanding is my way of talking about a more complex form of knowing that, you know, human beings also, if we're lucky, enjoy. Understanding is synthesizing and putting together the big picture. That's the sort of knowledge that I think isn't necessarily going to come from the mere acquisition of more information. Understanding is seeing how the facts fit together, what depends on what. Understanding is the sort of thing that we do with each other. I understand someone better if I understand why what their behavior is related to, let's say, their emotional state, why they're doing what they're doing. I learn a little bit about them as a person, and that gives me not just a set of discrete facts about what they're doing and their behavior, but actually gives me a deeper sense of how they are as a whole human being. That sort of understanding is a creative act, and it goes to the core of what's important to us as human beings. And that's the sort of knowing that I think we really need to make sure we're not ignoring in this time where we're increasing the amount of facts that we can allegedly access with the devices we carry around with us.
But let me better understand, I mean, how people sort of look at or relate to the truth. In 2015, PolitiFact awarded Trump the lie of the year and included many different examples of what they called lies. Yet he is the front runner. So is being caught in a lie or being truthful really important to voters?
I'd like to think it is. The thing that really strikes me about Donald Trump's campaign in particular, and I think has struck many people, is the fact that he fears no inconsistency. He can say he can support universal health coverage one day and then reject it the next day, and so on and so forth. And one of the things that has stumped a lot of commentators is how is he getting away with that? Well, the reason he's getting away with it is because people are responding to what he's saying, not at the level of explicit literal truth, but in this more emotional response. And they don't care about the details. What they care about is the projection of authority and confidence that he is putting out there. And that is a classic way in which people can become manipulated and start to think that things are true that aren't true.
So you say it enough times and it gets repeated on the internet enough times, it becomes true.
That's exactly right.
So do you think this is a recent shift? I mean, human beings have always had a kind of complicated relationship to the truth, haven't they?
Always. And that's part of what it is to be a human being. Part of the human condition is realizing that the world is bigger than you are and that finding out accurate information about it for all sorts of reasons, practical or philosophical, can be incredibly difficult. What's different now is the ways in which we're acquiring that information. So if we think about what I call in the book Google knowing is knowledge through digital interface. But that way of knowing, the way in which we know things through our smartwatch, through our smartphone, our smart clothes, the ways in which those sorts of devices are giving us information is becoming increasingly intimate and close to our bodies, both literally and figuratively. And that fact, combined with the speed and availability of the information that Google Knowing gives us, is distinctive. We used to say that perception or seeing is believing. Now we tend to say that Googling is believing.
Hmm.
And that has changed. I mean, it used to be that, for example, and I have more computers than I can actually shake a stick at. I'd be embarrassed to tell you how many devices I have. But what used to be the case, right, that we, in having to, let's say, take some time to figure something out, go to the library or have a conversation, that time gap allowed us to perhaps reconsider, to think again, to have a moment to stumble across some new piece of evidence that we might have not if we had had just it at our literal fingertips. So I think there is something new.
Michael Patrick Lynch is with us. He's a professor of philosophy at the University of Connecticut and author of the new book, The Internet of Us, Knowing More and Understanding Less in the Age of Big Data. Well, the question that philosophers like you have been grappling with for centuries is, what is the truth? You know, we know that there are relative truths, but I'm just wondering, like, is it possible to find the truth on Google?
Sure, I think it's possible to find the truth on Google. The hard part is knowing whether you found it, right? We need to develop techniques that give us a sense that we have reached it when we do. And I think what you're asking is, can we ever really know for sure whether we've reached the truth through Google or any other device? We can never know for sure. Certainty is not something that human beings really are very good at. But we can approximate certainty. We can get closer and closer the more evidence that we have for our opinions. It's evidence that we really need to be searching for, because evidence is what points the way to the truth.
Michael Patrick Lynch, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Michael Patrick Lynch, professor of philosophy at the University of Connecticut. He's going to be talking about his book, The Internet of Us, Knowing More and Understanding Less in the Age of Big Data, at the Music Hall Loft's Innovation and Leadership Series on Wednesday, April 13th. There's more on the book and information on his appearance in New Hampshire at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for spending some time with us today. We do invite you to share what you heard with others. Just go to wordofmouthradio.org for a deep list of segments to listen to or post on social media or email to friends. And let us know what you're curious about, the stories and sources that you're finding interesting, or what's scratching at your sense of wonder. We find the best ideas tend to bounce around by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 here on NHPR.